Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to an astonishing level of professional burnout on the part of doctors and nurses on the front lines of caring. There's a sense of being overwhelmed, undersupplied, unsupported, and even being vilified. My guest today has become an authority on physician burnout after suffering from it herself throughout the trials of her training and much of her early career as a hospital medicine attending physician in her native Canada. She was so burnt out, she sought solace at a Zen meditation retreat center in a program for health professionals seeking recovery. Her journey there is detailed in her new memoir called We Are All Perfectly Fine. It's a memoir of love, medicine, and healing. Jillian Horton is an associate professor of internal medicine at the Max Rady College of Medicine at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. She's also the director of the school's program in physician and learner wellness and directs the health and humanities program there. Dr. Jillian Horton, mindfulness expert and author of the memoir We Are All Perfectly Fine, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Jillian Horton, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start where your book starts by you taking us on that journey. You were on an airplane flight headed to eventually to Rochester, New York, to a place called the Chapin Mill Retreat Center. Why were you going there?
Well, thanks so much for having me, John. I was headed to that retreat a few years ago now because I was going to join a group of physicians and other healthcare providers from all around the world, many of whom were going to learn mindfulness, but most of whom were also struggling with burnout. So I, due to a chance meeting with one of the people who runs and directs that retreat, I thought, this sounds interesting. I booked the trip and I went down there thinking that I would have a restful 5 days and not at all expecting that it would be the first step to a feeling of completely transforming my professional and personal life.
Yeah, it really, the book is so good, your memoir, We Are All Perfectly Fine, because you there's so much humor in it and emotion. But one of the things that's so funny in it is how skeptical you are sort of throughout like maybe the first four of those 5 days. I mean, you gradually build some relationships. But this is, I don't know how to best describe it, but it sounds kind of pretty crunchy granola, lots of pillows and yoga and things like that. And you kind of approach all of that a little bit skeptically at first.
Well, you know, John, I think I'm a lot like most physicians. I think we are a tough crowd. You know, if we think of the academic settings that most of us work in, when someone comes to give grand rounds, it's like people at the end are lining up to try to poke holes in the arguments of what other people say. I mean, that is just an embedded part of the physician's psyche by the time we've been practicing for a while. And I think I brought that same sensibility to that experience when I went down there. I thought, what do these people know? How is this going to help me? This seems like such a profound mismatch between the tension and the stress and the trauma and the drama that we all experience in medicine. And, you know, the reverse was actually true, that these people were absolutely the best ones to help other physicians deal with all the things that you and I both know cause so much turmoil in our lives because they understood them. And therefore, they were able to come up with a meaningful approach to helping physicians develop some additional skills when it comes to mindfulness and self-regulation and just learning different ways to handle some of our most challenging experiences.
In one of the pivotal chapters of the book, there was even a period of time, I think it was maybe a full day of the retreat, where you and the other participants were silent, were required in a sense, or asked to be silent. And you were a little bit, as you are throughout the book, a little irreverent, and you wound up going outside and bumping into this other fellow who I think is somewhat of a composite character, but or didn't want his name revealed or something like that. But anyway, you and he bond over really a sense of shared trauma of your medical training and your medical work because you have both. And I mean, you are definitely someone who has achieved a great deal and maybe an overachiever. You had a career in music before medicine, and you were, I think, valedictorian of your medical school, medical university. So you are someone who has had high achievement. And, you know, you're very revealing in the memoir because you talk about how these feelings of imposter syndrome, and yet you're not even sure during your residency, reflecting back on it, that at the time you were doing well. And in fact, they're welcoming you and saying, hey, you know, join our faculty. You're our star. You're going to be our best. So there's this lack of perspective we have. But anyway, you wind up talking to this guy during this silent retreat. And what he reveals to you is that everyone at this retreat has experienced some form of trauma, whether it's a specific case or repeated cases. What was it for him and what was it for you?
Well, you know, I think it is cumulative for so many of us. I think there are personal experiences that sort of bleed over into our professional lives. You know, I think that's really common. Many of us go into medicine because we have a family member who was ill. That was a case for me, of course. And our whole understanding of our own identities is somehow related to that illness. But, you know, for me professionally, and for many physicians, if not most physicians and nurses and other healthcare providers, you know, most of us from those early days in our career have a series of patients who, no matter what we later go on to learn, we believe early on in our career that we failed those people. We failed to notice something. We failed to adequately appraise a situation where there was danger. Or maybe we just failed to emotionally meet somebody's need. It doesn't have to be, you know, the most egregious thing that happened, but where this sense of failure permeated. And, you know, when I went to this retreat for the first time, and then I've been back subsequently, and as you know, I've spent some time, quite a bit of time actually learning now to teach this program to other physicians. But that theme is consistent, that people are all carrying these things that feel unsayable, these cases we cannot forget, people that we continue to be reminded of our whole lives. And in many circumstances, we feel as if we can't even talk about these things because sometimes the thing that we're carrying might even feel trivial. You know, and I've had this experience in the years when I was an associate dean, when a student would come and say, Dr. Horton, I need to meet with you urgently. Something terrible happened. And they'll tell me a story about some perceived error that they made. And I'm really not exaggerating. I'll be listening to the story and it will take me 30 minutes to even understand what the mistake was that they think they made. So the point being that early in our careers, we totally misjudge our own role in many situations. We ascribe a larger to life role for ourselves than we actually inhabited. We carry this and we never really get to unpack it, explore it. It's not something we would bring up spontaneously. So at these retreats and these kinds of gatherings with colleagues, so often, and just fascinating, this is the kind of stuff that bubbles up. This becomes a safe place to talk about these things that we wouldn't even normally pay attention to. And that experience seems quite consistent, quite universal, and quite important for all of us. It's really a very profound catharsis. So it's so interesting.
Well, I was just so intrigued that this place exists. And I mean, Chapin Mill Retreat Center outside of, I guess, Rochester, New York. And it has, I mean, I guess they hold various types of things, but some Zen Buddhism retreats as well that are perhaps, you know, outside of the medical realm or physician realm. But, you know, it seems like it was a very intense bonding experience. And those just 5 days, you made some very deep relationships that I think, do you still carry with you to this day?
I absolutely do. And in fact, just earlier this week, a colleague of mine at MD Anderson invited me to give an annual lecture that's given there. And, you know, this colleague and I, we have really not spent that much time together physically. I mean, we overlapped at one retreat on one occasion. He was up here visiting to give a lecture and we spent a bit of time together. But we were just both commenting on this intense feeling that we each have and that so many of our colleagues that we know through this experience and this type of work have, a feeling of deep closeness, you know, the kind of closeness that most of us have not experienced since residency, that we feel with our close friends, our close colleagues, but in a more sustained way. And it's just, we both find this so fascinating that proportionate to the investment of time that we, you know, spent in one another's company, the deep sense of just alignment, shared vision, common humanity that we feel with one another, I think it's really a byproduct of when you create a psychologically safe environment for people. When you create an environment where people can be themselves, people who normally are highly guarded, highly regulated, highly trained to hold themselves back, to keep emotions in check, it is amazing how much lost time we can make up for. And I think the relief that we all feel in those settings translates into a lot of closeness. And the other interesting thing, John, you may have heard of this polyvagal response that happens when people meditate in groups together. And one of the things when we're doing meditation or focused attention practices, one of the things that we're actually doing is, you know, is we're increasing the tone of our vagal nerve. And the vagal nerve, as you know, is this amazing, the longest nerve, the 10th nerve in the body, the 10th cranial nerve. And it regulates all these incredible things, our feelings of well-being, how slowly we digest our food, the softness in our voice, the way that we gaze at someone. You know, all these things, when our vagal tone is higher, and it's the thing that we're directly influencing when we do meditative practices, focused attention practices, when the vagal tone is higher and we're with other people, we get something called polyvagal amplification. So my tone goes higher, and then because mine is higher, yours goes higher, and because yours is higher, mine goes higher. And so we get this kind of blissed out feeling of being together. And sometimes, you know, people think, well, it's the meditation, but it's all these other things that we don't typically talk about or think about in medicine that are, you know, somewhat intangible and yet have a very real basis in physiology and in science. So I often think that's one of the reasons why we have this feeling of closeness despite these short investments of physical time together, that polyvagal reaction that we get. And you sort of start to think about that as, boy, there are probably other ways in life, in medicine, in society, that we could take advantage of that kind of thing if we wanted to build more benevolence and feelings of goodwill and agreeability towards one another. We could all use in society right now some polyvagal amplification.
I like the way you say that. I mean, it sounds so technical, like you're going to, with the scientific aspect of it and the anatomical, you know, physical, physiologic, it's more likely to convince probably a physician that's less perhaps in touch with his or her own feelings and more skeptical about wellness or mindfulness, that type of thing.
And this is something I often say to groups of non-physicians who are working in administrative capacities, who are trying to deal with this kind of crisis of healthcare provider burnout. One of the things I often say to them is that they have to understand that in general, physicians speak in evidence. So when you say to a group of physicians, we think our institution should do this, one of the first things you get back is, what's the evidence? And that's how we were trained, right? We have all been thoroughly immersed in the way of thinking that we call evidence-based medicine. And so it really shouldn't surprise us that when we want to try to offer things to physicians that will make their lives better, that will make their inner quality of life better, that will make their cultures better, we also need to be prepared to say to them, here's the basis for this, not just some person, you know, thinks that this is a good idea. This is really part of the strategy for how we begin to encourage people and programs to adopt these kinds of things. But you do remind me of one other point that I think is really important, because whenever people hear that a doctor is talking about mindfulness and how it helped them, in many cases, they respond rightfully from a place of hurt. They say something I probably would have said several years ago, which is, don't you dare talk to me about mindfulness or my own resilience. I work in a system that is killing me. I work in a system where there is more administrative work than I could ever possibly do, where I spend 2 hours of my day for every hour that I spend physically caring for a patient. So don't you tell me that I need to do deep breathing exercises and that that's going to fix the problem. So this is always a really important caveat for people, that whenever I talk about, you know, how mindfulness work and how this retreat and all these other skills that I've learned, how they've improved my life, I cannot emphasize enough, that doesn't mean that the physicians or the healthcare providers were the problem to begin with. We work in a really broken system. We know unequivocally that organizational factors are the primary drivers of burnout, not the people who work within them, not breathing deeply enough or learning to meditate. But my rationale for this work has always been, if people like you and me want to survive long enough within the system in order to change it for the next generation, We have to find whatever ways we can to boost our own survival, to make it more likely that we can continue to tolerate that damaged, dysfunctional, toxic environment so that we can do that work that we dream of doing, which is to change the system. So I always think it's really important to say that. Otherwise, sometimes people walk away and think, well, great, but what about all these other things in the system? And they are absolutely right. The system is the problem, but it's incumbent on us, if we want to try to fix it, for the people who are looking to us to do that, to find ways to keep ourselves healthy so we can simultaneously do that work.
I'm going to reintroduce you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jillian Horton, who's an associate professor of internal medicine at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, there at the Max Rady College of Medicine. And Jillian Horton has written a marvelous memoir called We Are All Perfectly Fine, a memoir of love, medicine, and healing. Jillian Horton, I learned that it's not actually your first book. You also, I think, co-authored a graphic novel about medicine. I was really intrigued. I haven't gotten a copy of it yet, yes, but I'm definitely going to check it out. Tell us about your prior book.
Well, graphic medicine, you know, is such a perfect example, I think, of one of those areas where different aspects of art and humanities and medicine and science can align. You know, we often talk about art and science as if they are two separate entities and dichotomies, but for me, they really exist in a continuum. So graphic medicine is really, you know, when we write or co-create comics about serious issues. And it has a long literary tradition, of course, as you know, and many of your listeners will know. So yes, several years ago, when I was working as an associate dean, I, of course, love this art form. I've loved it as a literary form. Books like Mouse by Art Spiegelman rocked my world many years earlier. And approached a colleague and said, you know, I really want to find a way to make students listen to what I want them to know about what it feels like to be a medical student. There are a lot of unsayable things that we don't talk about enough in terms of our personal narratives. You know, we often don't tell students, I struggled too, I suffered too, I had imposter syndrome, I doubted myself. So this struck me as a really great way to create something that wasn't like an information pamphlet about self-care. We don't need more of those. Something that students would pick up, engage with, and feel very viscerally. So yeah, that was my first effort, not widely disseminated. You know, this was just something that I created and published with a very talented graphic artist. But, you know, just another great example, I think, of how we, when we want to really address, you know, we can call it mental health among healthcare providers. We can call it burnout, self-care, whatever. But we also have to be creative when we think about how we are going to make those messages and those stories have the most impact and the most punch.
You mentioned earlier that your family's health is what led you to a career in medicine, you think. And that seems to be a pretty big part of the memoir, actually. And you have a sister named Wendy, who's actually significantly older than you, but had a sort of catastrophic diagnosis and was kind of unable to live independently. But talk about how your sister Wendy's illness, you know, impacted your life.
You know, I often say to people, John, that my sister's story is really the central story of my life, because I think in so many ways, everything that I do now in some way traces back to my earliest experiences with her. And they were experiences bearing witness, seeing how the medical system treated her, seeing how doctors treated her, seeing how the average person on the street treated her. And it wasn't good. You know, I so often struggled with the question, why can't people just be kind to her? Why can't the medical system accommodate her needs? Why is it always incumbent on, you know, my family, my aging parents, to drag her to medical appointments where they sit in the waiting room for 3 hours and have a 5-minute appointment, and you're always treated like something is your fault when you have a question that the system can't answer, that doctors can't answer. There's always, you know, there had been so much painful stuff just really infusing so many of those encounters. So for me, you know, you've mentioned my some of the graphic medicine work that I do, and of course, even writing a book. I mean, they're all hints that there are other things that I wanted to do with my life before I became a physician, and other things that I seriously considered, including, you know, just I wanted to write and be a playwright and all these other things. But at the end of the day, I could not walk away from what I had seen as a child. And what I had seen as a child was a system that didn't even treat my disabled sister as a human being, a system that marginalized families, a system that didn't put patients first, it put them last, and a system that, you know, really didn't serve anybody particularly well. So when I went into medicine, my mission was to be the opposite of so many of those other doctors that I had seen. There were some really wonderful ones, by the way, too. I don't want to minimize their role or the power of their example. It's just that we're wired to remember the bad things, right? We have this inherent negativity bias that traumatic experiences, horrible things that people say and do, will always stick out in our minds more than the positive things. That's just an evolutionary way that we are hardwired. So for me, those people became what I would never allow myself to be. And a big part of how I ended up working as a medical educator too. You know, it was really important to me that I devote considerable time to working with students to help them understand that unkind words or an appearance of indifference or a feeling to patients that we don't care about them or aren't emotionally present for them. I wanted to train students who understood that all of those things are damaging, that they're experienced as traumatic and really painful and humiliating for patients on the other side. And so that motivated me for many, many, many years. And I think it was just kind of a shift for me to suddenly say, we have a lot of other people looking after students, but who is looking after practicing physicians? Who is looking after faculty? Who's standing up for those people and helping them not get into a point where they start, you know, losing sight of why they're doing what they're doing, or they start feeling disconnected from patients, or they get into a situation where they have compassion fatigue and are no longer being kind to people. So I think that was, you know, one of the really surprising twists for me in my career, that I would find myself really trying to tell a story about how these things happen to doctors. I never imagined that I would get to a point where I would, you know, really be interested in that process, because previously, early on in my career, I just judged it. I just existed in opposition to it. And later on, I came to understand that it does happen for some reasons that are kind of baked into our training system and our work system. And if we want it not to happen, we have to put up some protection around the physicians who experience those things so that they have a little bit of a net beneath them and they don't get to a point where they start to behave in ways that would have been completely unacceptable to them if we could take them back in time and show them what they might become. It isn't what they would have wanted, and it isn't what we'd want for them as a society either.
Well, I wanted to ask you a sort of a comparative question. You know, you live and practice in Canada where you do most of your work, but you know, you've had these forays into the U.S. where you've made an impact mm-hmm. with your writing, certainly, and your mindfulness teaching. But, you know, I guess I would say some of us in the medical community view Canada, I mean, there's probably two prongs. I mean, some view it as, you know, like basically socialist medicine, and others view it as sort of this enlightened, very, everyone's in the Canadian system. That is, if you live in Canada, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have to necessarily worry about going bankrupt from your medical costs. And yeah. So we tend to have this perhaps over-idealistic viewpoint on Canadian healthcare, that it's going to take care of everyone, and there's this ethos. And so one thing that I would say surprised me, but, you know, it maybe shouldn't be surprising, is that physicians there suffer from many of the same mm-hmm. maladies and career types of burnout that, you know, we do here in the United States, where there's kind of that added sort of economic pressure.
Absolutely. So a couple of key differences jump out at me, you know, having a lot of American friends and working collaboratively with a lot of American colleagues around the issue of physician burnout. One difference, you know, one thing that I know is more challenging for you and my other American friends and colleagues, it's the insurance burden, the paperwork burden, the time that you have to spend on the phone getting approval for things, the amount of what we call click fatigue, you know, having to fill things in virtually. It is worse. You have a higher documentation burden, more of that, what we call pajama time, right? The time that people have to spend after they get home completing tasks, than we have in Canada. However, we still have a lot of it. And some of it is that the kind of purpose of it is a bit different. So what we rarely have is related to care, needing to get special approval for procedures, for, you know, being able to look after somebody in the hospital. We don't have that problem. However, we don't have universal pharmacare coverage. I mean, we have the illusion of it in certain provinces, but, you know, lots of our patients cannot afford the medications that they should be on. We have to use second-rate things that we don't want people to be on. We still have to spend a lot of our time doing that same kind of thing. It's just that the people that we're negotiating with are a bit different. But one thing we do suffer from, even though we don't have that problem of, you know, being able to treat people, we don't have to worry about anyone being denied basic care. We are not a centralized system. We have provinces that have their own siloed systems that have very little communication with other provinces. So we have the same kind of wastage, the same kind of problem where we spend, you know, a huge amount of dollars on healthcare and, you know, are still not one of the highest ranked healthcare systems in the world. I think the last survey I saw rated us, you know, as kind of ninth relative to other systems that have comprehensive care system. So we have a ton of bloat, wasted dollars, repetition, poor communication between institutions, multiple electronic record platforms, terrible, you know, kind of organizational things. And COVID has brought that all to the forefront. We don't really have a well-directed federal government response. We have lots of piecemeal responses that are all handled differently by different provinces according to political ideology in some cases. So I think it is actually one of the great delusions that COVID has revealed for us as Canadian physicians. I know if you'd asked me 2 years ago, who will fare better if there is a global pandemic? Will it be Canada? Will it be the United States? And we have fared better on some metrics like deaths per capita, but in many other metrics, we have fared horribly. I mean, I live in a province that 8 weeks ago, we were COVID capital of North America, and we still had an atrocious performance when it comes to COVID blasting through our personal care homes and our failures to support our racialized communities. And now we're poised to fail kids in the same way. So I think it's brought a lot of really difficult truths into focus for us. Our healthcare system, if we thought 2 years ago that we had things to be smug about, we have a lot less to be smug about than we would have ever realized. And I think all we can hope for is that in the wake of that experience, we are able to, and it comes back again, you know, to this idea of fortifying ourselves, developing the skills so we can continue to stay in this system to begin to answer some of those really difficult questions. What went wrong? What do we believe about ourselves that we no longer can demonstrate is true? And how are we going to continue to, you know, start again and rebuild the system so that our patients get the care that we deserve? And so our healthcare providers in the process of providing that care are not eaten alive.
The name of the memoir is We Are All Perfectly Fine. It's a memoir of love, medicine, and healing, and it's by my guest today, Dr. Jillian Horton, who is an associate professor of internal medicine at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. Dr. Jillian Horton, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, John, and someday I hope we get to meet in person.
Dr. Jillian Horton is an associate professor of internal medicine at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. Her memoir is called We Are All Perfectly Fine. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening and please stay safe out there.